Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Our musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one. Today we celebrate the birth of a composer. Biography.com calls one of the greatest Western composers of all time. Hence, he was known for such works as the Brandenburg Concertos, Toccata, and Fugue in D minor. Who is this famous composer and organist who was born on this very day back in 1685? Was that A, Richard Wagner, B, Johann Sebastian Bach, C, Frédéric Chopin, or D, Claude Debussy? And question number two, the White House is the most visited home in the United States. What is the name of the second most visited house in the United States? Hint, this house was purchased on this very day back in 1957 for just over $100,000. Second most visited home in the U.S., what's it called? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of March 19th. Well, it was on this very day, back in 1904, that Richard Strauss conducted the world premiere of his Sinfonia Domestica, his fifth of seven appearances at Carnegie Hall in New York City, 1904, today. And it was 82 years ago today, 1939, that God Bless America was recorded by Kate Smith, 1939, today. Loretta Lynn's Coal Miner's Daughter introduces our country music news. It's entitled Walter Scott Asks Loretta Lynn, published in Parade magazine on the 14th of March, 2021. The Coal Miner's Daughter singer-songwriter, 88, will release her 50th studio album, Still Woman Enough, on March the 19th. With homage to Mother Maybelle Carter and the Carter family, and collaborations with Reba McEntire, Carrie Underwood, Margot Price, and Tanya Tucker, it celebrates her fellow females of country music. What was your goal for album number 50? Recording is what I do, who I am. I guess I just want my fans to always have something new from me to listen to. Still, Woman Enough is the name of your 2002 memoir, one of your new songs, and also this album. What does it mean to you to still be woman enough? We as women sometimes feel we are not enough, smart enough, pretty enough, and on and on. I've had the same struggles, so I made this saying, Still Woman Enough, as my pep talk to myself. When I wrote the song, I wanted it to be about being strong and liking who I was as a woman. What is the pleasure in joining forces with other women artists? I love each and every one of them. Tanya has been my friend for almost 50 years. She was just a little girl starting out when we first met. Reba and Carrie, I think, are the best in the business. But more than that, they are good people. Margo and I got to know each other the last few years. I love her songwriting, and she sings it with heart and guts. I see a little bit of myself in her. At 88, are there still questions you are trying to answer about life? I'm still learning. Only God has all the answers of life, and I can't wait to ask Him.
Well, a lot of things have changed since way back then. And it's so good to be back home again.
And in classical music news, we have this true crime story. Stolen violin once valued at $1 million, stored in Danbury for years. This is published in i95rock.com by Lou Milano on the 12th of March, 2021. International intrigue, big money, and deathbed confessions. It sounds like the plot to a movie, but it's a true story. And most of it involves Danbury, Connecticut, and a man named Ed Wicks. Wicks was not just any Danbury resident, instead a famous inventor. His wife, Anne, was a Juilliard-trained singer, and his daughter took music lessons from a talented violinist who coaxed Ed into fixing stringed instruments. Word spread about Ed Wicks' talents, repairing string instruments, and this is when he unknowingly became part of an international whodunit case. One day, a very nervous Julian Altman walks into Wicks' office. Ed said at one point this guy had two different cigarettes going at the same time, and he had this violin that he wanted me to look at. Ed immediately recognized this as a beautiful instrument and said, "This is a Stradivarius." A Stradivarius, by the way, is a rare stringed instrument made by a member of the Italian Stradivari family in the late 1690s through the mid-1700s. The nervous man replied, "No, no, no, it's not a Stradivarius. It's just a really good copy." Ed is suspicious. He eventually fixes it up. The guy comes back and takes it out and plays it beautifully. Ed and his wife, being lovers of music, take a liking to this guy now, and they befriend both him and his wife. Now go back to 1936, Carnegie Hall, New York City. Violinist giving a concert. A guy named Julian Altman, who worked in a shop right next door to Carnegie Hall, loved music. He got to know the guys who guarded the back door of Carnegie Hall and found out that they liked cigars. So he'd bring them cigars, and he'd get to stand there and listen to the concerts. So one day, while the guards were going out to smoke the cigars, Altman offered to watch the door. He then ran up to the dressing room, stole the Stradivarius, hid it under his clothes, and took off. The violinist Altman stole it from gets paid by Lloyd's of London $30,000, which in the 1930s was a lot of money. Lloyd's now owns the violin, if it's ever found again. It became an international intrigue, but Lloyd's eventually sees it as a lost cause. Decades later, this same Julian Altman brings this same Stradivarius to Ed Wicks, who fixes it. Julian later gets in legal trouble and is sent to prison for a year. Before sentencing, he hands Ed the violin and a sealed letter and says, "You can't tell anybody I gave this to you. I'll come back and get it." During his year in jail, however, he dies. His wife then claims the Stradivarius from Ed and receives $250,000 from Lloyd's, who had said that if anybody ever finds it, they'll pay 25% of its value. thus ending the story of the million-dollar violin stolen from Carnegie Hall and stored in a Connecticut home for half a century.
Bohemia is the place to be. I get too hungry for dinner at 8. I like the theater, but never come late. I never bother with people I hate. That's why the lady is a tramp.
Ella Fitzgerald, The Lady is a Tramp, introduces our jazz music news. It's put out by Britannica.com, and it's entitled Ella Fitzgerald Biography. American jazz singer who became world famous for the wide range and rare sweetness of her voice. She became an international legend during a career that spanned some six decades. As a child, Fitzgerald wanted to be a dancer. But when she panicked at an amateur contest in 1934 at New York City's Apollo Theater and sang in a style influenced by the jazz vocalist Connie Boswell, instead, she won first prize. The following year, Fitzgerald joined the Chick Webb Orchestra. Webb became the teenage Fitzgerald's guardian when her mother died. She made her first recording, Love and Kisses, in 1935, and her first hit, A Tisket, A Tasket, followed in 1938. After Webb's death in 1939, she led his band until it broke up in 1942. She then soloed in cabarets and theaters and toured internationally with such pop and jazz stars as Benny Goodman, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, the Mills Brothers, the Ink Spots, and Dizzy Gillespie. She also recorded prolifically. During much of her early career, she had been noted for singing and recording novelty songs. From 1956 to 64, she recorded a 19-volume series of songbooks in which she interpreted nearly 250 outstanding songs by Richard Rodgers, Cole Porter, George Gershwin, Duke Ellington, Jerome Kern, Irving Berlin, and Johnny Mercer. This material, combined with the best jazz instrumental support, clearly demonstrated Fitzgerald's remarkably interpretive skills. Although her diction was excellent, her rendition of lyrics was intuitive rather than studied. For many years, she was one of the best-selling jazz vocal recording artists in history. She appeared in films, on television, and in concert halls throughout the world. She also recorded a number of live concert albums and produced a notable duet version of Porgy and Bess, 1957, with Armstrong. During the 1970s, she began to experience serious health problems, but she continued to perform periodically even after heart surgery in 1986. In 1993, however, her career was curtailed following complications stemming from diabetes, which resulted in the amputation of both her legs below the knees. Fitzgerald's clear tone and wide vocal range were complemented by her mastery of rhythm, harmony, intonation, and diction. She was an excellent ballad singer, conveying a winsome, ingenious quality. Her infectious scat singing brought excitement to such concert recordings as Mac the Knife, Ella in Berlin, and was widely imitated by others. She garnered 14 Grammy Awards, including one for Lifetime Achievement. She also received a Kennedy Center Honor for Lifetime Achievement in 1979 and the National Medal of Arts in 1987. And in music research and technology, we have this article entitled, Why Copyright Lawsuits Are Scaring Off Songwriters. With chart-topping artists being sued for millions in infringement claims, a chilling effect has hit the studio. This is published by Amy X. Wang in Rolling Stone, February 2020 issue. Most of the world knows Robin Thicke, Pharrell Williams, and T.I.'s Blurred Lines as a half-forgotten hit song from 2013. The music industry remembers it as a worst nightmare. In the 5 years since a court ruled that Blurred Lines infringed on Marvin Gaye's 1977 Got to Give It Up, demanding that Thicke and Williams fork over $5 million to the Gaye estate for straying too close to the older song's vibe, the once sleepy realm of music copyright law has turned into a minefield. Chart-topping musicians have been slapped with infringement lawsuits like never before, and stars like Ed Sheeran and Katy Perry are being asked to pay millions in cases that have many experts scratching their heads. Across genres, artists are putting out new music with the same question in the backs of their minds: will this song get me sued? There's a lot of confusion about what's permissible and what's not, says Sandy Wilbur, a forensic musicologist who served as an expert witness for the defense in the Blurred Lines case. Because cases are decided by the average listener who is not an educated musicologist or musician, she notes, labels are very afraid. Since that game-changing ruling in 2015, Wilbur says, she's received triple the number of requests from music companies to double-check new songs before they are even considered for release. How did this culture of fear drift into the recording studio? The answer is twofold. While copyright laws used to protect only lyrics and melodies, a prime example is the Chiffons' successful suit against George Harrison in 1976 for the strong compositional similarities between his My Sweet Lord and their He's So Fine. The Blurred Lines case raised the stakes by suggesting that the far more abstract qualities of rhythm, tempo, and even the general feel of a song are also eligible for protection, and thus that a song can be sued for feeling like an earlier one. The article skips down. Songwriters who may not have the financial wherewithal of celebrity artists but are equally liable for copyright claims are often the most vulnerable. We're all nervous and afraid to fall into a battle over something as minor as a few notes or words, says Ross Golan, a producer and songwriter. The popularity of cheap music production software, which offers the same features to every user, has added another layer of risk. Music is now more similar than it is different for the first time, Golan says. People are using the same, in fact, sample packs, the same plugins, because it's efficient. Then there's the issue of the finite number of notes, chord progressions, and melodies available. Or as Wilbur puts it, there are no virgin births in music. Music comes out of other music. The copyright lawsuit booth and its unintended side effects may be just getting started. Article skips down, ends with this. The Blurred Lines ruling has a chance of going all the way up to the Supreme Court, thereby reopening a Pandora's box. Will the latest ruling clarify the scope of music copyright or muddy it even further? Litigators are all hoping for more clarity.
Lunch, then a rush. Kelly caught that outbound bus to Vegas.
Not her.
Woo, go girl.
We're all out here talking trash.
Bye.
Making bets. Lips wrapped around our cigarettes. She always thought she was too good to be a waitress. We all say that we'll quit someday. When a ship comes in, we'll just sail away. We just blow smoke.
Casey Musgrave's Blowin' Smoke introduces this next article. It's entitled, Walter Scott Asks Catherine McPhee. Parade Magazine, March the 7th, 2021. The American Idol Season 5 runner-up and Smash star, 36, goes for laughs with her new series, Country Comfort, March 19th on Netflix. She plays Bailey, an aspiring country singer who takes a job as a nanny for a handsome, widowed cowboy named Bo and his five children. Will she sing in every episode? There may be one or two episodes that don't have music. We have a few dream sequences, similar to what Smash did, but typically the writers found ways to get the music into the show naturally. You were on Broadway with Waitress just before the quarantine shut everything down. Was Broadway an inspiration? It was an aspiration. I really did patiently wait for the right show. I had been offered other Broadway shows coming off of American Idol, but I wanted a show that hadn't been played by 100 different women. It was a very small group of women who played the role of Jenna in Waitress. I felt like I was part of something really special. Catherine McPhee. Interview in Parade Magazine. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, who is this famous composer and organist who was born on this very day back in 1685, known for the Brandenburg Concertos? Was that A, Richard Wagner, B, Johann Sebastian Bach, C, Frédéric Chopin, or D, Claude Debussy? As noted in biography.com, the correct answer is Johann Sebastian Bach. Answer B. That entry notes that Bach had a prestigious musical lineage and took on various organist positions during the early 18th century, creating famous compositions like Toccata and Fugue in D minor. Some of his best-known compositions are the Mass in B minor and the Brandenburg Concertos. Bach, born in 1685, was struggling with his eyesight by 1740, but he continued to travel and perform, visiting Frederick the Great, the King of Prussia, in 1747. In 1749, Bach started a new composition called The Art of Fugue, but he did not complete it. He tried to fix his failing sight by having surgery the following year, but the operation ended up leaving him completely blind. Bach suffered a stroke later that year and died in Leipzig in 1750. During his lifetime, Bach was better known as an organist than a composer. Few of his works were even published during his lifetime. Still, Bach's musical compositions were admired by those who followed in his footsteps, including Amadeus Mozart and Ludwig van Beethoven. His reputation received a substantial boost in 1829 when German composer Felix Mendelssohn reintroduced Bach's Passion According to St. Matthew. Bach is considered to be the best composer of the Baroque era and one of the most important few figures in classical music in general. And the answer to our second question, the White House is the most visited house in the United States. What is the name of the second most visited house in the United States? And I gave as a hint that this house was purchased on this very day back in 1957 for just over $100,000. Correct answer, Graceland. According to a January 2019 Wide Open Country article titled 18 Things You Didn't Know About Graceland by Bobby Jean Sawyer, Elvis bought the mansion when he was only 22 in 1957 for $102,500, which is about $900,000 in today's money. Graceland, which was named a National Historic Landmark in 2006, is the second most visited home in the United States with over 700,000 visitors a year. Only the White House has more visitors. Even though the name Graceland will forever be associated with Elvis, the mansion was named by the family who originally owned the property after an aunt, Grace Toof. Elvis ran a $500 a week grocery bill. We all know about the king's love of fried peanut butter and banana sandwiches, but People reports that the superstar also required several other things to be available at all times in his pantry and fridge, including a case of Pepsi, 6 cans of biscuits, and sauerkraut. Elvis loved having his family close by, so close that he moved his parents and grandparents into Graceland with him. Graceland's meditation garden is the final resting place for Elvis, along with his parents and grandmother. Arguably the most captivating room in Graceland, the Jungle Room, was where Elvis really let his decorative taste go wild. The kitschy den, featuring green shag carpet, plastic plants, wood paneling, and tiki-inspired decor, was where the king spent much of his time. By the mid-1970s, Presley's career had stalled, and his interest in recording had wavered. So RCA did what they could to entice the superstar. They turned his beloved Jungle Room into a makeshift recording studio. There, Presley recorded his final musical output, which included a cover of George Jones' She Thinks I Still Care. The album Elvis, Way Down in the Jungle Room, a 2-disc set, was released in 2016. Well, let's close out today's program with Birthday Boy Bach's Sheep May Safely Graze. We've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program is also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words: kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. So long, until next time.